We'll hear argument now in number 88-1083, John Doe Agency and John Doe Government Agency versus John Doe Corporation. Mr. Kneedler.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. This case concerns the interpretation of the law enforcement exemption to the Freedom of Information Act. That exemption, Exemption 7, provides that the Act, quote, does not apply to matters that are records or information compiled for law enforcement purposes, close quote, if the production of the records or information would produce any one of six enumerated harms. This Court has repeatedly recognized the importance of the public and private interests that are protected by Exemption 7 in Robbins-Tyre and Abramson and in Reporters Committee.
Mr. Kneedler, do you know anything about how the parties all got this John Doe denomination in the district court?
There was the proceeding. The Court of Appeals granted a motion for the proceedings on appeal to proceed under seal. And as a result of that, we have continued to comply with the requirement that the agencies be referred to as John Doe Agency and John Doe Government Agency. We have no objection to disclosing the names of the agencies. We've just continued under that practice because that was the order in the Court of Appeals.
The Court of Appeals directed right. That everybody be designated as a John Doe. Right.
Or under seal so that at least with the names under seal so that the public would not know.
Thank you.
As I've said, the Court has repeatedly recognized the importance of these law enforcement interests, and after Abramson was decided, Congress, in fact, built upon Abramson and expanded the coverage of Exemption 7 to ensure that law enforcement information would be protected irrespective of the format in which it was collected. Foremost among the purposes of Exemption 7, as this Court and Congress have repeatedly stated, was to protect the government's case from interference. The circumstances of this case well illustrate the importance of Exemption 7 in this regard. The Freedom of Information Act request was submitted in the context of an ongoing grand jury proceeding. It was submitted by a target of that investigation, and the district court specifically found that that production of the documents would jeopardize the proceeding. The Court of Appeals.
Mr. Kneedler, at the time the request was made here, had the documents, in your view, been compiled, or were they compiled after the request was made?
The documents were compiled after the request was made, but in our view, they were compiled for law enforcement purposes. They were compiled for law enforcement purposes before the request was denied. The sequence of events was that the Freedom of Information Act, the criminal investigation began in 1985. There was a subpoena in 1986 in February to the corporation. As a result of that, the corporation alerted to the investigation, filed a FOIA request in September of 1986 with the John Doe agency, the auditing agency involved in the case. That agency consulted with the law enforcement agency involved in the case, and on the advice of that law enforcement agency, denied the request on November 18th. And then on November 20th, the documents deemed responsive to the FOIA request were transferred from the first agency to the second agency.
What constituted the compilation?
Well, I think most in the sense that the statute uses the term compilation, I think that once the Department of Justice in the course of this consultation said, yes, indeed, these documents are relevant to our investigation, we want them and don't disclose them. We think at that point the records were gathered together or incorporated.
A request by the agency to withhold them constitutes a compilation, in your view?
Well, I mean, there are several senses in which they could be. I think the initial sense.
Is that what you're asking us to adopt?
Yes. The court doesn't have to adopt that. The court doesn't have to go that far in this case because the records were subsequently physically transferred to the second agency, and they're included in a larger collection of documents that the second agency
had. Well, one
had.
Could take the position that you have to physically assemble the documents somehow, I suppose.
Or gather them, take them together. That would be one possible construction, I suppose, of the Act. And here that was done because the second agency gathered the documents, put them in its files, which concededly. Its files
well, depending upon the timing. Now, you could read the statute as meaning they have to be compiled when the request is made, I suppose.
I don't think that construction would fit with the sense of the statute. This isn't a situation in which there should be a race to the documents in the sense of who has a prior lien on them or something like that.
When do you say, Mr. Needler, they were compiled?
Excuse me, when?
When?
When? Well, it's our view that they were compiled at the time that the second agency, speaking through the Assistant United States Attorney, said, yes, those documents are included in the subject matter of our investigation, after the first agency consulted with the second agency.
Well, the second is the FBI, is that it?
Yes.
And the first is DCAA?
Yes.
Were they ever compiled by DCAA?
Yes. DCAA retrieved the documents from its files, and at that, it consulted with the FBI, and the FBI said, yes, those documents are relevant to the investigation. At that point, the documents took on the status of being compiled for law enforcement purposes. In our view, the statute...
At that point, before the transfer of the documents to the FBI.
Yes, we think that they were compiled even before that. The court doesn't have to reach that question in this case because, in any event, by the time the district court was asked to act in this case, the documents had been transferred. At that point, at the very least, they had the status of being compiled for law enforcement purposes in the files of the second agency, and they were they wouldn't have been improperly withheld at that point because the information they contained was compiled by the second agency.
Well, under your approach, though, don't we run into something of an ante litem motem problem? I mean, can the government just undertake this compilation after it knows that the documents are going to be requested?
Well, it's as long as the documents become protected at any period of time, the exemption applies. And by the same token, if the exemption doesn't apply after a certain period of time, for example, under Exemption 7, if a grand jury investigation terminates, then under Exemption 7A, that exemption would no longer apply because the documents would no longer be serving the purpose for which they were gathered in a pending proceeding. So what we're saying is that an investigation is a dynamic thing. At this case, the investigation came in, or the FOIA request came in right in the middle, or actually fairly early in the investigation. And it's not necessarily true that the investigating agency would have all of the information yet in hand. And in fact, in this case, the FOIA request may well have alerted the agency to particular documents in its possession that were relevant to the investigation.
Mr. Needler, why was the transfer to the FBI so promptly made?
Because to bring them promptly within the control of the FBI because they were relevant to the ongoing investigation. Both the agency that had them and the FBI acted responsibly. The two agencies work as a team in an investigation like this. The FBI doesn't have the expertise with the details of every program in which fraud or corruption might arise, and so the FBI has to rely on the expertise of the other agencies. In this case, the auditing agency. The auditing agency said, we want to tell you we have relevant information, and the FBI says, you're right, it does. Please give it to us, and we'll send somebody over for it. And it was done contemporaneously with the denial of the FOIA request. And I should point out that after the corporation appealed the denial by the DCAA through its procedures, that agency stated that the request was being denied because the records were under the control and possession of the FBI,
That's why I asked the question.
Well, yeah, but there's no suggestion that this was done to avoid complying with a FOIA request.
There isn't.
I'm not aware of any. I mean, that argument could be made, but not for any devious purpose at all. The records came to the attention of the investigators. They concluded they were relevant and properly included them within the investigative file.
Now, I have one other question. Has the grand jury ever acted with respect to the corporation?
No. I'm informed that the investigation is still pending, although all of the documents at issue here were submitted to the grand jury after they were received by the agency.
I take it that in some circumstances the audit agency could itself assert this exemption if it thought a fraud had been committed and it was compiling documents?
Yes.
In other words, it's not necessary that the FBI be implicated.
No. In this case, that makes it especially vivid that the exemption is invoked. But under established case law, once an audit or a monitoring becomes focused on possible wrongdoing in a specific context, that becomes an investigation, and that may well occur by an auditing agency. Therefore, I would just like to urge the court not to suggest, because it wasn't challenged in this case, that the audit was not did not have law enforcement purposes. That's not to suggest that every audit conducted by this agency doesn't have law enforcement.
Is there any necessary in this case to find that it was the FBI's request that triggered the exemption?
It was not, because I think if the again that makes it vivid, but even if the DCAA had never consulted with the FBI, after it retrieved the documents, looked at them and said, we know these are relevant to this ongoing investigation, and denied it on that ground, and then transfer them to the FBI, the same result would obtain, because...
Well, then it wasn't the FBI request that triggered the exemption?
Well, there was consultation between the two. The record doesn't disclose who originated the idea or the decision to withhold them. But the denial letter says that on the direction and advice of the Assistant United States Attorney, the records were denied. But that's consistent with the relationship of the two agencies in a law enforcement situation. Under Title 28, the Attorney General is given control over criminal investigations. Section 533 directs the Attorney General to appoint officials to investigate and prosecute crimes against the United States. The U.S. attorneys have that responsibility. And under Section 516, the Department of Justice is given responsibility to litigate cases involving the United States, including securing evidence. So those statutory provisions at least mean that when there is a criminal investigation going on, that it's entirely proper that the Justice Department be consulted and that the Justice Department have at least a primary say in whether the document should be withheld.
Mr. Needle, that's a very strange result, isn't it, that had the agency complied with the request before consulting with the FBI, or had it decided not to consult, the document would have been openly available to the public, right?
No.
Or had the request been made before the FBI decided to compile the documents, anybody could have gotten the document.
No, maybe I misspoke. But at the time the request came in, there was already a criminal investigation going on.
The document hadn't been compiled for that criminal investigation, according to your theory, right?
Not at the time the request came in,
right,
but at the time it was retrieved. And its relevance to the investigation was identified. At that point, the agency categorized it, included it within.
But at any time before that, the very same document could have gotten out. So this person was just a couple of days too late, perhaps.
I think, presumably, whenever it was requested, at least after the criminal investigation was initiated. Whenever it was requested and had been retrieved by the agency, the same result would have followed.
If the agency consulted the
As I say, that happened in this case, and that makes it clear. But if the agency on its own said this is relevant to an ongoing investigation, law enforcement investigation of this corporation, and it says, I mean, this had to do with cost overcharges in a particular year, and they retrieve the records and look at them and say,
what if it had been asked for the day before the investigation was complete, was begun? Then there's no doubt that the same document could have been obtained.
Well, at least if an investigation was not begun before there was a response.
Well, the document just changes its character from having, you know, been compiled. Now, you say compiled means gathered and assembled.
It means gathered together, assembled.
And that's the only thing it can mean?
Well, it can mean category. Well, I suppose it could mean shuffling documents together in a file.
Well, as I say, he compiled a wonderful pitching record. No particular athlete compiled a wonderful pitching record. Do you think that would describe his, I don't know, cutting out of newspapers
a lot of pitching records
of other pitchers and gathering them all together?
No. What
he produced it, right? Didn't he? He accomplished it himself. Can it bear that meaning?
It could bear that meaning, but looking at it in the context of what FOIA is aimed at, which is I think the important thing. These were records that were categorized by both the FBI and DCA as being relevant to the law enforcement investigation.
Namely, it has to interfere, be reasonably understood to interfere with a...
Right.
And if these documents had been requested before any investigation had been started, it would be awfully hard to say it was interfering with an investigation.
So under either that specific requirement of 7A or the threshold.
Well, what was the reasonable possibility of interference with an investigation here? The requesting party must have had copies of them already.
Well, we don't know what it had. We don't know what it had copies of. A lot of the documents.
They were the parties to the correspondence.
That's true. But a very substantial amount of the documents in a case such as this by an auditing agency like DCAA are all of the audit work papers that the agency itself generates. It could involve. In a typical case, it could involve interviews with witnesses.
So it involved more documents than just the initial correspondence.
Oh, absolutely. And the initial correspondence is in the record. The respondent has the initial correspondence.
Right.
He's just trying to look behind to the information that he doesn't have. If he already had these documents, it wouldn't be requested.
Needler, I don't understand this exchange. Are you asserting that in addition to meeting D, you have to meet A?
No.
You wouldn't have to show that these documents could reasonably be expected to interfere with enforcement proceedings. You wouldn't have to show that if the one you're arguing applied, D.
We're arguing principally A here, not D. We're arguing interference with the ongoing investigation.
Oh, you're not arguing that. Well, for that you don't have to show it was compiled, do you? You don't have to show that it was compiled by a criminal law enforcement authority. A doesn't require compilation by a criminal law enforcement
authority. Not by a criminal law enforcement authority.
What are we arguing about this for?
No, but the threshold, it has the all of Exemption 7 has an additional threshold, which is that the Act doesn't apply to records or information compiled for law enforcement purposes. And then each of the subparagraphs follows. There's a separate requirement for a law enforcement investigation agency.
I thought it always had to be compiled for law enforcement purposes.
That's true. It
has to meet A,
one
B,
of the,
C, or D.
Right, and the protection against any suggestion of overreaching or abuse is to check to see whether the particular record or information satisfies one of the substantive harms that Congress was concerned about. In Abramson, this court said it in construing this exact compiled for law enforcement purposes provision, said it's critical that the compiled for law enforcement requirement be construed to avoid the release of information that would produce the undesirable results specified. And in other words, the court said that the exemption has to be construed in a coherent manner so that information that Congress was especially concerned about wouldn't fall between the cracks. And I think it's significant in this regard that Congress in 1986, after Abramson, amended Exemption 7A and to provide not simply that records compiled for law enforcement purposes, but also information compiled for law enforcement purposes could be withheld. And it was the absence of the word information that was of significance to the dissenters in Abramson, because the Act at that point only referred to records. And in fact, the pertinent Senate report, as this Court recognized in Reporters Committee, was one prepared in 1983, specifically endorses Abramson and says that these amendments, which were intended to ease the burden of law enforcement agencies, were, quote, intended to ensure that sensitive law enforcement information is protected under Exemption 7, regardless of the particular format or record in which the record is maintained. So it's obvious that Congress was endorsing the view that this Court took in Abramson, that it's necessary to focus on whether the information that is at issue would produce, as long as it is categorized or identified for law enforcement purposes, would produce one of the six enumerated harms.
Mr. Needler, Abramson was 5-4 decision, as so many are. Is what you've just said the answer to this question? Could those of us in the dissent in Abramson vote in your favor here?
Yes.
And be consistent with that?
Yes. That's what I was attempting to say, that the addition of the word information, the absence of the word information, was of particular relevance to the dissenters in Abramson as I read those opinions. And Congress expanded the definition specifically to include information. And here there's no doubt that the information contained in these records is now compiled by the FBI. Now, copies of some pages of the documents were retained by DCAA when the entire batch was sent to the FBI, but that doesn't detract from the fact that the information has the status of being compiled for law enforcement purposes.
And Needler, do you think the district judge made the findings that there was that you asked for and with regard to subsection A, B, or C? Is there a finding that the records could reasonably be disclosure could reasonably be expected to interfere with enforcement proceedings?
What the district court said was that the production of the records or information would jeopardize, could reasonably be expected to jeopardize the grand jury investigation.
I don't understand that.
I think
what does it mean in practical terms? How could the disclosure of these records interfere with the grand jury proceedings?
Well, I think by grand jury investigation, the district court meant the entire investigation under the control of the assistant United States attorney, which included the submission of these documents to the grand jury. I mean, these documents were submitted some time ago. The investigation is ongoing. And the Vaughan Index and interrogatories that were prepared in this case were submitted under seal. They are filed with the clerk of this court. That the Vaughan Index explains in considerable detail how the disclosure of these records would interfere with the investigation. And this court, in other contexts, has recognized a number of ways in which that might happen. In Robbins Tire, for example, with witness statements, the court recognized that premature disclosure of witness statements could lead to intimidation or correction of the stories of witnesses. The disclosure of...
But we don't have that danger here, do we?
Well, the Assistant United States Attorney in a public affidavit in support of a stay did say that the records might disclose the identities of witnesses, and there's always the possibility that witnesses' testimony could be coached in a way that would interfere with an investigation. The disclosure of the records would also show the direction and strategy of the investigation. It would show what documents the government had and perhaps more significantly what it didn't have.
It wouldn't show the direction or strategy of the investigation unless you were foolish enough to tell the person when the person got them that these had been compiled for law enforcement purposes. If you didn't tell them that they were part of the investigation file, the person wouldn't have any more reason to believe that this was part of the investigation than any other document received under FOIA.
Well, I think in the typical case, precisely because the FBI and DCA do work as a team, or the FBI and whatever agency work as a team, the requester could reasonably expect that the records in the hands of one of the agencies either are or soon will be part of the
maybe, but it wouldn't indicate the direction of the investigation. You don't.
Well, it would show what records the government had at its disposal.
So would any FOIA request. So every document that you turn over fits the definition of A.
But that has been one of the principal purposes of protecting what. Of Exemption 7A, which is designed to prevent premature discovery, as was particularly recognized in Robbins Tire. Discovery that precedes the time that it's provided for under the rules of the applicable proceeding.
Mr. Kneedler, I'm still interested in the word compiled now. The prologue to 7 speaks of records compiled, but later on, 7D uses the same terminology. It says, in the case of a record compiled. Now, under the Freedom of Information Act, a record can mean a single document, can it? Unlike files, it means a single piece of paper is a record, right?
Well, not necessarily a single piece of paper. It could mean a document, which would have a number of...
Yeah, it could mean a single piece of paper, too, couldn't it?
It could mean, yes.
How do you compile a single piece of paper, except in the sense that I use the word compile?
Well, I think that's one of that's a good example of why the word compiled has to be given a meaning that comports with the overall purposes of the statute, which is that once a particular document has become the subject matter or included in the subject matter of the investigation, it is compiled or
gathered. It may mean produced. Why wouldn't that be in accord? If you interpret compile the way you just have, would you say that a document that is exempt under 7D would lose its status after the investigation is terminated and the compilation is broken up?
When you're speaking of a confidential source, which is what D does, that protection extends. In fact, it's one of the principal purposes. It has to extend beyond the time the investigation.
I agree with that, but I don't know how you could extend the extension beyond the breakup of the criminal investigation if the only thing that causes it to be a record compiled is the gathering together of it for a criminal investigation. You're shooting yourself in the foot.
No.
D will terminate as soon as the compilation is eliminated.
No, the investigation terminates, but under this court's decision in Abramson, once the documents are originally attain the status of being compiled for law enforcement purposes, at that point they continue their protection even beyond that point, and it's critical that they do so.
Mr. Needler, what's the difference between compiled and filed?
Compiled and filed?
Yeah.
I think in many cases there may not be any. I think the word filed.
Why didn't they use filed here?
I'm not sure why they did. I think compiled has a broader connotation that suggests the categorization of the records rather than the physical act of putting them in a file.
Before you sit down, I'd like to get back to the Chief Justice's question. Who asked for the John Doe designation?
It's my understanding that the respondent...
You understand, and does the record show it?
Yes, I think it does. I'm sorry, I don't specifically recall. I think it was the respondent.
You don't think it's important as to who asked for it?
Well, we have no objection to lifting it, and we never have, particularly with respect to our...
I don't see how you can have any objection. Doesn't listen to any record.
We have no objection to disclosing the names of the particular agency.
The government did ask for it, didn't it?
I don't think we asked for the. I could be wrong, but I don't think we asked for the protection of the two agencies, because we would not normally care about the disclosure of the identity of the agencies. If there are no further questions, I'll save the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Mr. Eisenberg, would you enlighten us, Mr. Eisenberg, what you know about the designation requirement of John Doe's in this case?
Your Honor, the corporation requested that the records be sealed after an affidavit was filed by an assistant United States attorney, which disclosed a public affidavit in the FOIA case, which disclosed for the first time by name the subject of a grand jury investigation. And because we didn't know what was going to come after that affidavit, it turns out that's the only affidavit on the facts ever submitted in this case. But because we didn't know what was coming next, we asked under Rule 6E that the records in the case be placed under seal. We did not ask for this designation of the caption and have never thought it made any difference whether the defendant agencies are identified by their name or by some John Doe reference.
Well, how about the name of your client?
We do not, since the government has also just volunteered that the grand jury investigation is continuing, we do not believe that the client's, the subject of the investigation's name should be identified in the caption or in...
You don't think litigation in federal courts under FOIA is a matter of public notice?
Your Honor, I don't want to make an issue of this because, in fact, this is a public corporation which has disclosed in numerous SEC filings all of the details with respect to this investigation of which it is aware. From documents like the affidavit in this case, there's no secret of who the corporation is. I just want the court to understand that the only reason we had for requesting that any portion of the case be kept in confidence was because the initial affidavit, for the first time, disclosed that this corporation was under a grand jury investigation, and under Rule 6, there's specific provision for placing under seal matters affecting the grand jury.
Thank you.
But you have no objection to the disclosure of the name of the company now?
Your Honor, the name of the company has been disclosed in the media. It has been disclosed in SEC proceedings.
Suppose we asked you if we could amend the caption.
Yes, I have no objection to the court amending the caption if it finds that more efficient or useful in the court's discussion of the case or decision of the case.
If we have a lot of cases called John Doe versus John Doe, it'll be hard to refer to them.
Yes, Your Honor, but there are. There are quite a few of them already, I believe. We have wandered somewhat from the record in this case in the course of the government's presentation of the facts. I would like to emphasize that, as I just have, that there is only one affidavit on the facts in the record in this case, and it appears on page 60 and 61 of the joint appendix. It's an affidavit submitted by an assistant United States attorney named Sean O'Shea, who was the grand jury attorney, and it states all the facts that were in this record when the district court made its decision and when the Court of Appeals made its decision, with one qualification. There were a number of exhibits attached to the government's answer to the complaint, which are also in the record. And all that he says about the facts is that the documents in this case were removed from the DCAA by the FBI for the purpose of presenting them to a grand jury, that the documents were compiled by the DCAA. There is no statement in this affidavit or in any subsequent affidavit that they were ever compiled by the FBI or recompiled by the FBI or that they were compiled by the DCAA for any law enforcement purpose. It is clear from the affidavit that they were compiled in the normal routine of the agency's performance of its oversight functions, in this case, reviewing contractor charging practices under government defense contracts. There is no suggestion in this affidavit or in any other affidavit that the DCAA was cooperating in a law enforcement investigation with the FBI at any time. What the record establishes, and this now is mainly through the exhibits and some affidavits that were submitted after the court decisions in connection with stay motions and the like, is that these documents were generated in 1978 by the DCAA in connection with one of these routine government contract audits, that they were in the DCAA's files for 8 years after that, in fact, in dead storage. The first response to the request to the DCAA for the documents is, give us more time to locate them. They're very old. Obviously, they were not being used for any law enforcement purpose at that time. They were used for archival purposes. They were sitting in the dead files of the DCAA. There's no suggestion anyplace in this record that at any time after they were retrieved from dead storage and withheld from the requester, the corporation, that they assumed a law enforcement purposes in the DCAA's possession. What the DCAA said when they denied production of the documents was the FBI, in fact, an assistant United States attorney, whom they designate by name, Mr. Milton, has directed us to withhold these documents. Therefore, we can't give them to you. And in a later, and there is in the record, the letter from the DCAA to the same assistant U.S. attorney, in which they say to the U.S. attorney, since you've now directed us to withhold these documents and you have possession of them, will you handle this appeal that the corporation is filing? No indication of any cooperation, joint effort, consultation. This was the FBI saying to the DCAA, don't comply with this FOIA request. We don't want you to give any of these documents to this corporation. And then seizing them from the DCAA and saying in the affidavit they filed, we're going to present them to a grand jury, therefore, for that reason, because these are going to be grand jury materials, you should not disclose them to this corporation.
That is, assuming that all happened the way you said, and I don't doubt it, Mr. Eisenberg, how does that advance your case?
I think it should be decisive, Your Honor, because the critical time in any case for determining whether documents have been compiled for a law enforcement purpose has to be the time the documents are requested, or at least the time when the request is denied by the agency.
Why is that so? It's certainly not the case for classified documents, for example. It's well established that you can classify a document after the request is made and then decline the request on the basis that it's classified. Why should this be any different?
Well, it's the very differences, Your Honor, between Exemption 1 and Exemption 7 that I think make it clear why that should not be the case under Exemption 7. Under Exemption 1, which applies to documents relating to national security, the exemption incorporates by reference an executive order. The classification of documents depends on what the executive order permits and provides for. Those documents contain state secrets. It makes no difference to their status when or for what purpose they were generated or where they are located.
No, but just because something is classifiable under the executive order does not mean that it is classified. Many things that are classifiable are not classified.
Yes, sir, but
isn't that right?
And
you acknowledge that you can classify them after the FOIA request and then deny the request saying this is a classified document.
That is all true, Your Honor, under Exemption 1. But the reason for it is that the executive order incorporated specifically into the statutory exemption provides that documents may be classified or reclassified after a request is made under FOIA.
Well, Mr. Eisenberg, doesn't the statute for Exemption 7 give the agency a 10-day period, which can be expanded if needed, in order to respond and in order to determine whether the record should be compiled for law enforcement purposes?
I'm not sure that the 10-day period is in order to determine whether the documents should at some point after the request be compiled.
Well, that is an interpretation one could place upon the
statute. Yes, Your Honor. Such an interpretation could be placed on it, but nothing happened here within that 10-day period.
But that isn't the isn't the interpretation the Court of Appeals embraced. The Court of Appeals said they were either had to be initially compiled for law enforcement purposes when they were first created. You defend that rationale?
Your Honor, I not only defend it, I defend it happily and heartily, but that is...
Well, that certainly eliminates this construction that you just said was one possible reading of the rule.
Your Honor, we have to put the Court of Appeals opinion in its proper context. And that depends on the posture of the case when it was considered by the Court of Appeals. The government did not present any Exemption 7 argument to the Court of Appeals. The government's argument in the Court of Appeals was that Exemption 3 protected these documents from disclosure because Rule 6E is a statute for Exemption E purposes. And because these are now grand jury documents, Exemption 3 is the exemption that the Court of Appeals should focus on in determining whether they should be withheld. That's what the Court
of
Appeals did.
Yes, but the Court of Appeals certainly addressed the requirement as to the documents being compiled.
Your Honor, it addressed it because the district court, without making any determination that these documents had ever been compiled for law enforcement purposes, relied on Exemption 7. For his conclusion that their disclosure would interfere with the grand jury proceeding.
Well, that's the decision the Court of Appeals was reviewing.
It reviewed that decision, Your Honor, but I think in fairness...
It was wrong.
I want to make a full response to the Court's question because that's the decision the Court must decide. This Court must decide whether to affirm or reverse. The government, relying on Exemption 3, in the Court of Appeals, could make all of the same arguments for not disclosing these documents because they were grand jury materials without having to meet any threshold requirement. And since they had made no record in the trial court, and there was no record in the Court of Appeals suggesting remotely any of the things that have been suggested in the Supreme Court as the factual basis for such a determination, the government had a way of defending the withholding of the documents that avoided entirely the issue that Justice White has directed attention to, whether they were compiled for law enforcement. Having made that tactical decision and lost on the Exemption 7 justification advance in the, I'm sorry, lost on the Exemption 3 justification advance in the Court of Appeals, I don't think that adds any weight to the attempt now to relitigate the same factual issue, whether because these documents were presented to a grand jury, we should now focus on Exemption 7. They didn't rely on Exemption 7 in the Court of Appeals.
Well, that's the question presented in their petition for certiorari.
Yes, Your Honor, and we...
And the Court of Appeals passed on it.
No, Your Honor, the Court of Appeals did not pass on it.
I thought the Court of Appeals did pass on the Exemption 7.
It considers Exemption 7, Your Honor, in this context. It says that the trial court relied on Exemption 7. The trial court did not make any determination, any finding, with regard to whether these records were compiled. That finding is essential for Exemption 7 to have any application. Obviously, in this case, they weren't compiled for law enforcement purposes. They were 8 years old. They were compiled prior to and independently of any law enforcement investigation. They were in the dead files of the DCAA when they were requested. They were not taken by the FBI or for presentation for any purpose until after that request.
Well, Mr. Eisenberg, your brief in opposition to the petition for certiorari, your reasons for denying the writ, you give three reasons. There's no conflict in the Court of Appeals. The facts here are unique because the records were 8 years old, and the decision faithfully adheres to the language of the statute and its legislative history. Now, our cases require that if you're going to make a point that we can't reach the question presented by the petitioner, you must make it in your brief in opposition or it's deemed waived.
We're not suggesting that you can't reach the point, Your Honor. We're suggesting only that the Court of Appeals did not make the broad ruling.
Well, here's
a
section of the Court of Appeals opinion.
It's
headed up, Application of FOIA subsection
B7. Yes. And it goes right ahead and concludes that the B7 is not available.
Yes, Your Honor, and I'm giving you the reason that the Court of Appeals gave. The reason the Court of Appeals gave is that the only evidence in this record is that these documents were compiled by the DCAA, that no record exists for any finding that they were subsequently or at any other time compiled or recompiled.
That unless they were compiled eight years ago for some law enforcement purposes, they couldn't be compiled later for that purpose.
No, Your Honor. What the Court of Appeals said on that subject is that merely taking records that are not exempt under any of the statutory exemptions in the Freedom of Information Act and commingling them with an investigative file was not a basis for saying that those non-exempt records had acquired the exemption that applied to other records in that exempt file. In so stating, all the Court of Appeals was doing, in Judge Winter's opinion, was paraphrasing this Court's decisions in Abramson and Robbins.
Well, it says that
not making new law.
The Court of Appeals says that a government entity cannot withhold materials requested under FOIA on the ground that materials that were not investigatory records when compiled have since acquired investigative significance.
Yes, Your Honor. And it goes on to quote the Robbins and Abramson language construing the same compile for law enforcement purposes.
That's really an argument. That's your argument on the merits, really.
Yes,
why the government shouldn't prevail in its interpretation of Rule 7.
Yes, Your Honor. It's our argument.
So you're defending against the question presented in the petition.
That's right. We're not suggesting that the court can't reach the question. We're suggesting that on the record in this case, there is only one answer to that question. And the answer is that on the record in this case, there is absolutely no evidence that these documents were compiled for law enforcement purposes by the DCAA or thereafter by any other agency.
So you suggest that if the record showed that the FBI requested these records and said to the agency, please find these records, we think they might be relevant, and the agency says, well, here they are, and the FBI says they're relevant, send them over, you would say there's an evidence of their being compiled for law enforcement purposes?
If that happened, if the FBI initiated the request because it had some reason to believe that, I would not say that merely removing otherwise non-exempt files.
Yeah, but if all that happened, then the compilation requirement would be satisfied.
No, Your Honor, that would not be a compilation. That would be taking files from one place and relocating them to another place. Let me give you.
Well, why shouldn't we give the word compiled its ordinary meaning, which certainly could encompass gathering up and assembling some records and sending them over to the FBI? I mean, that would certainly be a plain, ordinary meaning of the word compiled.
Well, the government cited us to Webster's New Collegiate Dictionary for what it claimed were the ordinary meanings of the term to compile. and none of the definitions they cited included to seize, to transfer, to take custody of, to remove, or to commingle. And none of the definitions...
How about to gather up and assemble?
Not in Webster's. They did find in the third, in the reply brief, which we have not been able to respond to, they did find the third definition in Random House, a definition of compile as meaning gathering, for which the example given is the example Justice Scalia suggests, compiling data. That's the example given. Random House says that the definitions in its dictionary are listed in a prescribed order. The ordinary usage of the term is listed first in speech or in any other usage. And the more rare, archaic, technical usages are listed thereafter. This is the third of four usages. And it's compiling data that is the example. It is not simply relocating documents from one place to another place. Congress could have said, gathered up, it could have said, used for law enforcement purpose, it could have said, obtained for law enforcement purpose. There are so many words it could have used, but it chose one that has a very precise meaning. I have discovered, since this case was briefed, in all of the dictionaries we have consulted, and it's not the equivalent of what the FBI did in this case, whether they did it on their own initiative, in consultation with, or because they wanted to thwart the corporation's access to these records.
Mr. Eisenberg, is it your position that if these records were originally engendered, to use some word other than compiled, put together by DCA 8 years ago, and clearly at that time they were not for law enforcement purposes, they can never later attain the status of being compiled for law enforcement's purposes?
No, Your Honor. There is some law to that effect, but that position is not the position we have taken in our brief. Because there are cases like Crowley Maury, for example, in which the audit report itself is the impetus for the law enforcement investigation, when it's still within the agency's possession and control. Obviously, that's a totally different situation than that in which the documents are not being used at any time by the agency for a law enforcement purpose. So I'm not saying that there has to be an FBI removal in order for all agency documents to meet the threshold requirement.
Could an agency that's not engaged in law enforcement compile documents which later would be said to be compiled for law enforcement purposes because the FBI or some other law enforcement agency needs them to prosecute someone?
Well, it's very hard to deal with that in the abstract without specific facts and documents.
You don't rule it out in the abstract.
The Court of Appeals did not rule that out in the abstract. We do not rule that out in the abstract. But in this case, there's no evidence that that ever happened.
Is the answer you gave to the Chief Justice consistent with the rationale of the Court of Appeals?
It's entirely consistent.
It seems to me that it isn't, because I thought the Court of Appeals said they were created before the investigation, and that ends the case.
That's what the Court of Appeals said, Justice Kennedy, in finding that these documents were compiled by the DCAA for non-law enforcement purposes. It does not say that because of that, they either could subsequently or could not subsequently be recompiled by any other agency, including the DCAA, for law enforcement purposes. What they say is that there's no evidence, there's no record in this case, there's no argument in this case, there's no issue in this case as to whether that happened, because the government never asserted that.
I don't think that's a fair reading of the opinion. They say the documents were compiled in 78 by this agency 7 years before any law enforcement agency got involved. And then it says they were thus not compiled for law enforcement purposes within the meaning of this. They say that's enough to...
By that agency, the DCAA. That's the finding that they're making.
No, it's not. They were thus not, quote, compiled for law enforcement purposes, unquote, and are not exempted by subsection E7.
Your Honor,
E7.
If it has
not compiled by anybody, is what their holding is.
And that's why I think context and posture is so important. There was no argument in the Court of Appeals
by the government. I understand your point there.
That they've been but
their reasoning is that since they were compiled by a non-law enforcement agency for a non-law enforcement purpose, and that's all the record shows, that's the end of the ballgame. That's what they say.
On this record, in light of these arguments and the government's position in the Court of Appeals, yes. Not for all purposes, under all circumstances, in other cases where a different record is made.
This is a good deal less significant than we thought it was, I suppose.
I'm honored.
We're just reviewing whether they were indeed gathered, right? You're willing to say you can gather them. They just weren't gathered here. Is that it?
Your Honor, I am honored to be here at the first argument of the first day of the court's new term, but I have no idea why this case would lead off the court's new term. It has no significance on the record in this case as a construction of these key words. We point out in our brief that the government demeans Professor Howe's compilation of the Holmes-Lasky letters in his famous work by comparing it to what the FBI did in this case when it removed custody of these documents from the DCAA. But let us assume for a moment that instead of publishing this historic work, what Professor Howe did was this. He learned that someone else was on the trail of Justice Holmes' letters. So first, he directed Justice Holmes not to disclose them to someone else or anybody else. And then he appeared in Justice Holmes' chambers and removed the letters from Justice Holmes so that no member of the public would thereafter have access to them. We might call such high-handed conduct by many names, but I don't think any of them would be compilation. Without sugarcoating it, that is just what the FBI did in this case. By doing that, they thwarted the administrative process in all FOIA cases, and they did it without any of the justifications in an executive order, such as apply to Exemption 1 cases, which specifically authorize that kind of process after an FOIA request is filed by the explicit terms of the executive order. A document may be classified or reclassified. That is not the case with respect to any of the other exemptions, and the fact that they had to say in an executive order, documents can be classified or reclassified. There's nothing about compiling or recompiling an Exemption 7. It means that if they had just said classified, they would not have assumed that classified then classified or reclassified. You wouldn't have to use both words if the government's interpretation of Exemption 7 have merit. If I may borrow a phrase from the government's reply brief, it would trivialize Exemption 7's threshold test to equate the conduct in this case with the compilation of information or records for a law enforcement purpose. Despite the focus on semantics and grammar in the briefs, the argument between the corporation and the government is not just over words. What the government really is concerned about is the ability of a subject of an investigation to obtain any information, any evidence that might be useful to the subject of the investigation, which he could not obtain prior to or unless he is indicted under the federal rules of criminal procedure. It's because of those provisions in Exemption 7 that the President vetoed the 1974 bill, that the Attorney General testified strenuously opposed it, and the FBI was apoplectic. Prosecutors much prefer a system under which they can carry on their investigations for 2, 3, or in this case, over 4 years, this investigation, we are told, has been in progress, while the subjects are on standby, and then make whatever disclosures the federal rules permit in the 70 days between arraignment and trial, and as close to trial as they can make it in any particular case. As North B. Walsh, which we discussed in our supplemental brief, points out, the Department of Justice has, in fact, again proposed an amendment which would prohibit use of the FOIA as a discovery device. But Congress has not adopted that amendment, and what it adopted over the strenuous objections of the Department of Justice in 1974, which is language which contains no such limitation. Having failed before Congress, the government would like an interpretation of Exemption 7's threshold requirement from this court that would nullify its significance. But to prevail in this case, the government must stretch the facts beyond recognition, write its own dictionaries and rules of grammar, and convince the court to rewrite the language of the statute and its legislative history. Since in our view, there is also no record in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Eisenberg. Your time has expired. Mr. Kneedler, do you have rebuttal?
I do, Mr. Chief Justice.
You have 4 minutes.
Thank you. There are several points I'd like to bring to the court's attention in the discussion that is focused on the word compiled. I think it's important to understand what Congress was driving at and what the responsible agencies understood Congress to be driving at. Because as this court said in Abramson, Exemption 7 is an exemption of substance and not one of technicalities. The first thing I want to point out is a passage from the Attorney General's memorandum, page 6 of the Attorney General's memorandum on the 1974 amendments to FOIA, which is discussed in the district court's opinion in Hatcher, which is discussed in the briefs. And it's the same page of the Attorney General's memorandum that was discussed by this court in footnote 5 of Abramson. And there the court says, the Attorney General, in explaining the recently enacted amendments, states that although ordinarily records used in monitoring agencies would not, or activities would not be covered by Exemption 7, it then continues to say, except where the purpose for which the records are held and used by the agency becomes substantially violation-oriented, i.e. becomes refocused on preventing, discovering, or applying sanctions against noncompliance with federal statutes or regulations. So here we have a contemporaneous construction of the statute by the Attorney General in a memorandum that this Court has relied upon and agencies have relied on ever since, saying that the status of records, once they become refocused on an exemption, is relevant. The second thing is, in the legislative history, Senator Philip Hart of Michigan, who was the sponsor of the amendment, described the threshold in the same sort of pragmatic terms in the same passage, another portion of which the Court discussed in Robbins-Tyre. Senator Hart said that the amendment is broadly written, but he wanted to point out that the material cannot be exempt merely because it can be categorized, to use that word, as an investigatory file. You also have to prove one of the six harms. But he did use the word categorized, which is exactly the concept that we are trying to explain as what the amendment refers to. And then he says, in broad terms, the exemption would apply whenever the government's case in court, a concrete prospective law enforcement proceeding, would be harmed by the premature release of evidence or information not in the possession of known.
Mr. Kneedler, if you read it that broadly, really, your reading is that records are information in the possession of a law enforcement agency if it meets any other.
No, it has to be focused on a particular, under 7A, it would have to be focused on a particular law enforcement proceeding or investigation.
I understand, but as long as it's in the possession of an agency and meets any of the six other requirements, you would say it had been compiled.
It would have to be in the possession for law enforcement purposes. In other words, in DCIA, they would have a lot of information, but once it becomes
but compiled means in possession of, I think, in your definition.
No, it doesn't mean, well, compiled.
Could anything in the possession of the agency for law enforcement purposes that meets these requirements not be compiled?
There also has to be an affirmative designation or selection of the document or listing, identification of the document as germane to the law enforcement investigation. And that is exactly what happened here in response during the 10-day period when the agency had to decide whether to release it or keep it. It concluded that it was relevant to the investigation. So that's the link that is necessary.
So under your theory, an agency could issue the FBI could issue a notice to all agencies in the government saying, X corporation is under investigation. We are interested in what kind of FOIA documents this corporation is trying to get in anticipating defense of this suit. Therefore, whenever you get a FOIA request from this corporation, let us know, and we want to see the document because it's relevant to our investigation.
No, first of all, a court may be able to examine those facts and see whether it is sufficiently relevant to a concrete, focused investigation. And secondly, the harms that Exemption 7 are designed to protect against is the principal protection against an overbroad application of the exemption.
Thank you, Mr. Kneedler. The case is submitted. We'll hear argument next.